Real families, real farms, real food. Welcome to Arizona Agriculture Connection with Maricopa County Farm Bureau. My name is Nicole Clements, Executive Director, and I'll be your host. Maricopa County Farm Bureau is the voice of agriculture in a community that thrives on the dichotomy of urban and rural agriculture operations. This podcast is a home for farmers, ranchers, food lovers, prospective agriculturalists, and those looking to connect the food on their plate with the farm that it came from. As we take an inside look at agriculture in Arizona, we will delve into topics like ag technology, policy, food preparation, and everything in between. You can find us on your favorite podcast platform with new episodes every Wednesday. Arizona Agriculture Connection is hosted by Maricopa County Farm Bureau and sponsored by Paloma Ready Mix and Materials, a proud supporter of agriculture and our communities. Be sure to subscribe and share your favorite episodes with your friends. For more interactions, follow us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn at Maricopa County FB. Now let's discover some Arizona agriculture. All right. Welcome back, Arizona Aggies, to another episode of Arizona Agriculture Connection. And this week, I'm very excited to cover a topic that I think a lot of people are interested in and probably don't know a lot about with our good friend here, Ben Mingus from Mingus Ranch. So welcome, Ben. Thanks for jumping on this week.
Thanks for having me, Nicole.
Absolutely. Well, let's just kind of start at the top. How did you get into ranching? What's your background? And, you know, what does that look like?
So I'm a fifth generation rancher, but it's not on the same ranch. So we ranch between Safford and Morenci, Arizona. Originally, my dad was raised in Alma, New Mexico, so on the Arizona-New Mexico border. But we came from the Texas Hill Country before there to the Arizona-New Mexico border and reserve in Alma area. So we've ranched in a lot of different places on a lot of different types of terrains, but I'm pretty rooted here. I hope that we can stay here in Safford.
We all like Arizona. I think it's a good place for everybody to put down some roots.
Politically, it's a lot better than New Mexico, at least for ranchers. You know, my friends over in New Mexico, they sure are on the hot seat a lot, it seems like, especially those that utilize public lands or that have wolves, and they complain about the wolves. You know, it seems like they have a lot more opposition in New Mexico than Arizona.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of it gets blown up in the media, and, you know, I think that happens about pretty much everything. But when you think about, sometimes that's going to impact how ranchers operate on a day-to-day basis and effectively impact their bottom line, then it makes it really tough. And that's one reason that it's not just the climate and the resources that are available in an area that make it good to ranch in. It's also, you know, the community that they're surrounded by. I think they're a lot more open to learning about ranching and about where their beef is coming from and, you know, why we do what we do.
Well, a friend of mine told me a big part of being a rancher is going to meetings. And so we go to quite a few meetings, but it seems like to get the word out there, it's necessary to make our case to show up. The world is controlled by those who show up. And so I make that a priority. But I know that in New Mexico, sometimes they show up and they're met with a lot of opposition.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that maybe you don't see on Yellowstone or something like that, where they're trying to depict, you know, the lifestyle and what happens. But, you know, oftentimes the most impactful moments are not spent outside on the ranch in the dirt, in the saddle. They're spent behind a desk or in a room full of people, you know, having tough conversations. The less glamorous, but definitely most impactful part of that role for sure. So kind of kicking it off here, when we talk about public lands ranching, so Arizona has 87% of our land in Arizona is public land, meaning only 13% is available for, you know, private purchase and operation. So when it comes to ranching and the amount of acres that you need, you know, it only makes sense that we would utilize those public lands. So what are some of the differences that you can speak to on ranching on private land versus ranching on public land?
I was in a presentation one time and I heard the person who was presenting asked the question, what do you need if you want to ranch on private land? Well, you need water and feed and fencing. What do you need if you want to ranch on public land? And the answer was a good attorney. The struggle of ranching on federal land is that you have a landlord who's telling you how to ranch, basically. And I think that's a little more hands-on with the US Forest Service than BLM. Forest Service puts together plans on how to rotate, your rest rotational periods. It seems like it's easier for them to cut permits on forest land than BLM, but that's just been my experience. The US Forest Service is under USDA, and so they weren't created with a mandate to graze like the BLM was. The Bureau of Land Management was created as a result of the Taylor Grazing Act of 1934. And so the BLM lands, there's a requirement for that land to be in grazing and Forest Service that's not present. But my relationship with BLM, we have all of our federal land is BLM land, and my relationship is very good, I would say. I think that you want to have a good relationship with your landlords, or else you're going to have a struggle when it comes time to, like now we've had an inch and a half of rain from the end of June in 2024 to the end of June in 2025. So the BLM is yet to cut our permit, but we have no feed out there, so we're having to ship cows. But I think that's a result of our good relationship with BLM. They're not trying to say you need less cows. They realize that we are out of feed, and so we're making that decision on our own. But I guess the intersection between BLM and private is one that I would say is what you make of it. It's all about relationships, and I think with anything when dealing with the federal government, it depends on your close relationships with those people who are the decision makers.
Absolutely. And it kind of just speaks to, how farmers and ranchers operate anyway. We're always looking out to protect and preserve our natural resources because, that at the end of the day, if you're not doing that, then you're not going to be able to continue operating anyway. So those tough choices that you're making, like shipping cattle out, that those are choices that we don't want to make, but depending on the year, depending on the availability of resources, is something that happens quite often that you have to sit down and make those tough decisions.
We were a potential habitat for a razorback sucker and a willow flycatcher in the 1990s. And in 1998, there was a decision on the Ninth Circuit to allow us to graze the Gila Box. And so we went through a lawsuit against BLM just to be able to graze the Gila River. Because any body of water could really be a potential habitat. Your pond in your backyard could be a potential habitat for a razorback sucker. But that's what the claim was on our place. And since then, I would say that our relationship with the BLM has been built on mutual respect. So, I'm not advocating for suing the federal government, but we were lucky enough to win that case. And I think it set a good precedent for other ranchers who utilize federal lands.
When you kind of make those relationships and maybe kind of switching gears, but the topic of, protected species and endangered species, so that's extremely impactful to what you do and how you operate. I don't know if you can speak to, I know we see a lot in the news, in the media about monarch butterfly and about the Mexican gray wolf. Can you speak to some of those and how that's impacted you and then how you've kind of worked through these solutions?
Well, I'm not that familiar with the monarch butterfly. I'll address that first. But that has potential to really impact the majority of ranchers in the West, from what I understand. And so that's something that we need to keep an eye on. But as far as the wolf goes, I've done quite a bit of work on the Mexican gray wolf. We were lucky enough in the One Big Beautiful Bill. There was a portion of a bill that Arizona Farm Bureau suggested and wrote and championed, which increased the reimbursement number from 75% of the value of the animal lost to 100%. What a great idea. You should be reimbursed 100% of the value of the animal if the wolf kills your animal. This is a federally protected species, so the federal government should be reimbursing ranchers not just for that, but for all of the expenses that the rancher incurs when talking about the wolf. There's a cost of bringing cattle from pasture to pasture. There's the cost of decreased conception rates. There's the cost of decreased weaning weights, cost of hay when you have to bring cattle in, the cost of added labor. All of these things are not reimbursed by the federal government. And so we're hoping that there can be, if the wolf is present on your land, then there's a cost. And that cost is an unfair burden for ranchers to bear, especially when you consider that 90% of the habitat, and this is agreed upon by wolf advocates and ranchers alike, that 90% of the habitat for the wolves is in Mexico. So we're caring for Mexico's wolves at our own expense. The American rancher is subsidizing the Mexican gray wolf, and we shouldn't be. If the American people want the wolves, they need to pay for it. And so I think that's one of the main messages that we've had over the past few years. Now, we have some hope of delisting the wolf with Congressman Gosar's ESA Act. That there was just a recently a congressional hearing on that with the House Natural Resources Committee. This would delist the wolves, the Mexican gray wolf, and it would delink the recovery with Mexico. Right now, the wolf can only be recovered if Mexico recovers a certain amount, and that's not fair. We can't count on another country in order for the wolves to be recovered. And so the count, I think, right now is 286 wolves. We need 320 for them to be delisted. But by their own admission, and this isn't recorded anywhere, this is just word of mouth. But Game and Fish does the count, and they have said that there's a 10% less, or I guess less than or greater than 10%. And so if you do the math, we're like at 317. So it's about time for the wolves to be delisted. And I think that would do our ranchers some good if they were no longer listed. We've been living with the wolves for 27 years in Greenland County. And, I could take you to a ranch, the Four Drag Ranch on Eagle Creek, that lost 140 calves in 2004. They've lost over 1,000 calves, which what would that equate to? Well over $1 million, let's say between $1 million and $2 million of losses that they've incurred. And they've received $5,000 in compensation. So it's just a travesty what the federal government has done to eastern New Mexico and or eastern Arizona and western New Mexico. And I think it's time for us to get some wins on that.
I think, I've seen it more recently from Arizona, California, New Mexico, where the wolves have been getting closer and closer to populated areas. And so with them reaching out, I think hopefully that will help shed some light to the situation and kind of what you guys have been dealing with for, well over 20 years now. But just understanding the impact of something like that. So, when we're all coming together at the table and trying to make these decisions, that they're made collaboratively, but we're still trying to raise food out here. So how do we work forward together to find the solution that works for everybody and ensure that everybody's fairly compensated? Because when you speak to, $1 million of losses, that's significant. And, how do you continue an operation like that and think about all of the other things that you battle on a daily basis? And that's a big impact.
I remember when Sonny Perdue, during the first Trump administration, he came to Arizona, and I asked him a question about wolves. And then later privately, he said, "What are we going to do about them?" And I said, "Well, I think we should ship them to Washington, D.C. Then people would care about them." And so maybe when they get to these places in like Santa Fe, or if the wolves were to get to Tucson, maybe people would start caring more about it. But right now, it's these very small communities that they're devastating, and there isn't the voter base to really make an impact in these communities. So all we have left is to tell our story.
Yeah, I think that, especially so America is such a large country, right? And we're so various from region to region. Everything's so different. I don't know a lot about agriculture on the East Coast. I, learned about oyster farming at one point, but I don't know a lot about it, and I don't know their struggles and what they face, right? And it's really a struggle to get that message out and share your story and try to help people understand, if they're not familiar with any of it, which is the whole goal of what we're doing today, right? So that's part of it. And, for anybody listening, that's why we're here also. If you have questions, if you have follow-up questions from this episode or any episode that you hear, you can contact us, phone, email, DMs, make a comment on the podcast, you can comment on the blog post. We're very easy to get a hold of, but that's why we're here, is to answer the questions and, hopefully have a greater understanding, from farmer rancher to the general public and, help them understand where their food comes from and why these topics are important, not only for the farmers and ranchers, but for them as consumers.
I appreciate that.
So you kind of spoke a little bit about the public land that you ranch is managed by the BLM. But those lands can also be managed by Forest Service or other agencies. So what is kind of the difference between those, or how does that get kind of assigned to each agency?
So U.S. Forest Service land is under the United States Department of Agriculture, and BLM lands are under the United States Department of Interior. And so while they intersect and are managed similarly, I think the laws regarding the management of each individual agency is very different. Forest Service lands are typically, big ponderosa trees. They're the lands that consist of our forests, except, in Arizona, there's the Tonto National Forest, which is a lot of saguaro country, which I don't know how that happened. But I think forests, they just separated them according to terrain. My family used to have a ranch over in Elma, New Mexico. And when the Forest Service became difficult, in their opinion, to deal with, they moved to BLM lands, and they had a private land branch in Horse Springs. But they moved out of there because they felt like Forest Service didn't have the goal of keeping cattle ranching alive on the forest lands. And I think we could still see some of that today. There are 84 vacant allotments in Arizona and New Mexico. So those are allotments that don't have a manager, don't have cattle, and they don't contribute to the local economy. I know of a ranch in the Blue, Arizona, which is a very remote area. It's over 500 head, and it's been a vacant allotment since the 1980s. I think 1987 was the last time it was grazed. So there's 500 head, that's what, hundreds of thousands of dollars that is not being dumped back into the local economy. And that's simply because Forest Service has said that they won't complete the NEPA. The NEPA stands for National Environmental Policy Act. And anytime I want to go and renew a permit, then they have to go through the NEPA. Or if I want to drill a new well on federal land, NEPA is required. But the Forest Service has said they don't have the resources to do the NEPA, so these allotments sit vacant. And I think that should be a main priority, especially when you're considering the lack of revenue that it is occurring in these rural areas in Arizona and New Mexico. When my family had the ranch in Elma, my great grandfather, broke his pelvis one time when he was back there. A horse fell over on top of him, and he broke his pelvis, and he stayed in a cabin. They were able to make it to the Colson cabin, which is about a 5-hour ride from the nearest road. And he stayed there for 6 months. And my grandmother and her mother would ride out and go and visit him. And the doctor would come out every 2 weeks on a horse to make sure he was okay while his pelvis healed. And in 2018, I had the opportunity to go to that cabin, and carved above there was his brand and the year that it happened, 1941. And it just brought to light the amount of work and persistence that ranchers in rough country on federal lands go through. And so that was a big appreciation I had. It was a motivator for me.
Yeah, that's an extremely impactful moment, for you, I can imagine. But just to hear that story of resilience, one of those, this too shall pass eventually. And, but so when we talk about kind of that relationship with the public lands and, how they're managed a little bit differently depending on the agency and that sort of thing, one of the biggest, maybe opposite sides of that topic would be, why are we using public land resources to graze private cattle? It's a big piece of discussion. And I think maybe the advantages of that are not talked about enough. So, can you share a little bit about the importance of grazing those lands and then, kind of how the ranchers are utilizing that land and reinvesting into it?
So I like to say that we're using the public's land to feed the public. And I don't know if there's a better use of our public land than to help feed the public. I would say that if you had asked someone in, let's say, 1930, that they were going, someone from east of the Mississippi, that they were going to set up a system where everybody could go on to livestock operations, like bird watchers, recreationists, hunters, boaters, everybody can go on to the cattle ranch. They would say there's no way that would work. But it has worked, and it's worked largely because the American rancher has invested an extraordinary amount of money in water development, especially when you consider wildlife. On our ranch, we have over 100 miles of water pipeline. We have over 1 million gallons of storage in the upland areas that wasn't present before it was a ranch. And so that's more habitat, that's more grazing for wildlife. It's a vested economic interest in caring for the land. And that's, I don't think that there's a better system in caring for our wildlife than a rancher. And when people think of expanding wildlife populations, they rarely think of helping ranchers. But ranchers are the reason that wildlife populations have expanded in the Southwest. You could point to the water expansion as the reason that these elk populations and a lot of the deer populations have expanded. So anyway, that's something that I think ranchers don't get enough credit for.
Absolutely. And then when it comes to, another kind of hot button topic, but this fire mitigation. So, we've seen this looming presence of wildfires, but grazing cattle on these lands actually kind of helps mitigate some of that from the get-go.
Yeah, more cattle, less fuel for fires, and more trees saved in the long run. Isn't
Just like your insurance agent will come and request that you trim back your bushes and clean up the brush and, just lower that opportunity for a spark to cause a situation. Cattle are doing the same thing. And again, for free, you're not having to pay someone to come out and do that for you. Cattle are doing it, they're getting fed, and, we're taking care of the lands in the process.
Oh, yeah. Well, I saw in California they reduced grazing on forest lands, and they realized that was a mistake. So now they're paying people to put goats on. It's not cattle, but they're paying people to put goats on in an effort to suppress the fuel for fires. And they didn't realize that they had a good system to start with.
That's one of it's funny, I see a lot on social media is, now people have a business where they have a herd of goats and people will pay them to come out and they put up a temporary fence and leave the goats for a night or a day or two. And, just like magic, it's cleaned up, looks brand new.
Yeah. Well, the difference is that I think people prefer beef to goat meat. And so, I think when you're producing a good product on public lands, it's a good thing. But I'm not here to knock goats.
We still love goats.
I support all animal agriculture. I'm just a little biased to cattle.
I do prefer, a hamburger over a goat burger, so I'll have to side with you on that one. Kind of leading into the nutrition side of it. So when you think about grazing in Arizona in the desert, we don't think about grass, right? Me coming from the Midwest, we've got grass everywhere. It's not a problem, but what is out there that the cattle are eating, and is it, fulfilling their nutritional requirements, and are they supplemented in any way?
Yes, we supplement quite a bit. We've gone through a whole list of different types of supplement. Right now, we're just on rumensin block, but we give liquid feed and we have an iodine deficiency in our area. So we put out iodized salt. Most of the native grasses is tuberosa, quite a bit of cydose actually. And then the annuals, when you could get a good rain, then fillery really helps you out. And so, yeah, we're the vegetation this year is very sparse, and the supplement hasn't made up for it. But I think in general, the native grasses get us by when we have a good monsoon.
I think one question I've heard several times from people is, are they eating the cactus?
Only when it gets really bad. The prickly pear, that I've heard that they could get addicted to prickly pear. I'm not sure if there's anything that proves that, but that's an interesting topic because, prickly pear is one of the most carbon sequestering plants on the desert. There's limited data on that, but the cattle, when in the 1950s and 60s, when it got really dry, then ranchers would burn all of the spines off of prickly pear. And so the cattle would eat prickly pear, and that's why we have so much. That's what BLM and Forest Services said, that that's why there's so much because of cattle. They blame the cow for the spread. Well, you just need a few prickly pear to offset the emissions of one cow. And so, and cattle are the reason that the prickly pear have been spread in the first place. And in addition to that, as we just said, they're the reason that they're the only thing that out there which would keep the prickly pear from burning if there was a fire, because they've eliminated the fuel. And so, they measured mesquite trees on my ranch. On average, each mesquite tree sequesters about 50 pounds of carbon if you were to Google it. And so we would need 170 mesquite trees to offset the emissions from one cow. Well, we have over 300 on our ranch. And so we're sequestering more carbon than we emit just with one species, just with mesquite. And so that's not counting prickly pear, which I said that is limited, but I heard that it was 500 pounds of carbon, which is quite a bit for each plant. So anyway, we're ranching in the desert, so it's 60 to 100 acres per cow. So that's 60 to 100 acres of vegetation to offset the emissions of one cow. So that's something that isn't talked about that often. And even when you get into a feedlot setting where you don't have all of this vegetation sequestering to offset the cattle. Well, they're eating feed that was grown just for cattle, and that feed, those corn stalks, they each sequester a certain amount of carbon. So I think the whole emissions thing is a bunch of bogus myself.
So when you speak to that carbon sequestration, can you define that? What does that actually mean?
It means how much carbon are you taking from the atmosphere? And so then carbon emissions, of course, is how much you put into the atmosphere.
So on your lands that you're ranching on, by kind of natural design, you're sequestering more carbon than your livestock is emitting.
Yeah, and I think that has to be true with basically every Arizona ranch. I'm not even talking about the soil yet. The soil sequesters a certain amount of carbon also. And I have no idea what that is, but if you were to add it all up, they should be paying it to ranch, paying to put more cows out there. If that's what their goal is to sequester carbon or to stop the emissions. But when you see the, that cattle emit this much, they never take into account how much they're responsible for sequestering.
So, being able to share this information, I think, is incredibly valuable, not only for, our farmers and ranchers like you, but also for, everybody to be able to understand this, because the topic is so extremely complicated that, how do you have a true understanding of how it actually even works or what it means from one headline or, one 3-minute news clip? So, the opportunity to share this information firsthand has been great, so thank you for that.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
So, also talking about kind of differences of Arizona to the rest of the world, Arizona is a fence out state. Can you kind of speak a little bit to what does that actually mean, and how is it kind of work in harmony for our ranchers and our urban communities?
Well, so what it's supposed to mean is that people have to fence my cattle out. I don't have to fence them in. So if I had cattle get onto a neighbor's a few years back, and the neighbor had a bunch of hay there, and I would keep going and keep going, and I finally said, I don't have to keep them out of your place. You have to keep them out. And so that's kind of what the design is of it. But it doesn't apply to everywhere in Arizona. There are no fence districts where you have to keep the cattle in your place. Municipalities also, you have, if you're up in a municipality, then you have to keep the cattle in your place in some of these places. But for the majority of Arizona, it's the general public who's responsible for keeping the cattle out.
And I know that seems a little bit backwards, but by design, it's unique for this public lands grazing situation.
Well, I can't be going around trying to make deals with every one of my neighbors or the subdivisions that I border and trying to, pay for the fence in all of these places when they could be building a fence themselves. If they want to keep other wildlife out of their place, then they have to pay for the fence. So just because somebody owns it doesn't mean that they can't keep, owns the livestock doesn't mean that they can't keep the livestock out.
Yeah. It's definitely unique coming from a Midwestern person. Well,
Really? What are the laws in the Midwest?
it's a lot of private land and you fence it in there. And the harmony that I see here between the ranchers, the hunters, the recreational community, I feel like it's pretty unique to this region and to be able to, work together really. And provide, now this land is, dual purpose and more than dual purpose. You're utilizing it for so many different avenues that you're really kind of maxing out and utilizing it as efficiently as possible and continuing to protect and preserve these lands so we can continue ranching and recreating and hunting, years and years into the future.
Yeah, I like the multiple use aspect for more reasons than one, but I think that I have an opportunity to show anybody who wants to come on the ranch what we're doing. And so I feel like that's garnered more support. I get people that stop me when I'm out there on a horse asking about beef, you know. And so I think I have a tremendous opportunity to share my story in agriculture just because my ranch is open to the public.
It creates such a unique relationship and opportunity. And, if I think about, somebody that's out camping and they see you out checking cows, like that's such a great situation that a lot of people will live in the city and not ever see a cow in real life, right? But you have people that enjoy the outdoors, but they don't have the space. So here we are on public land. We're sharing it together. Here's our continued purpose together, and here's how and why we do it. And that's so cool for you to be able to have those opportunities. So when we think about kind of all the struggles that the ranching community is facing, currently, drought being probably the biggest one, I would imagine. But you've got regulations and wolves and all sorts of other things, right? So I know you and your beautiful family there on the ranch, what is it going to take for you to continue operating on that ranch for the future of your family and your children's family and, 50 to 100 years down the road?
I would say a shift in the mindset. A lot of people don't know what public land ranching is, and they ask, well, why do we need, cattle operations on our public land? That's our land. I would say a shift in the mindset on, this land should be utilized for food. I think that would go a long ways, especially, in the urban areas. People like recreating on public land, and sometimes they don't like seeing cattle. But I think that a lot of the infrastructure that's there, a lot of the ranchers work the roads that allow them to recreate on public land. And so, just recognizing that ranching is an integral part to what makes public land, our access to our public land successful. I would say also a strong cattle market. We're experiencing a strong cattle market now, but that's because the cow herd is down. The nation's cow herd is very low. Also, the border's closed. And so, if you took those two things away, would we have a strong cattle market? I'm not sure. But I think for years, we're just barely getting by because of the price of cattle. And so if we could actually capitalize on some of the prices that go to the consumer, we've done that a little bit with direct marketing. I think that's something that is necessary for us to be sustainable into the future and to grow. As far as that, the only other thing we need is rain.
And we'll just keep praying for some more rain.
Strong faith.
Absolutely. So, are you selling a majority of your beef direct to consumer, or are you utilizing different avenues for that?
Actually, my wife and my mom, they've been selling beef directly to the consumer, but with the high price of cattle, then it's less and less worth it when you could, sell them directly through the sale or on a video auction. And you only make $300 or $400 more if you sell it directly to the consumer. It's sometimes not worth the hassle. But in the future, if the price of cattle goes down, then it would be worth it for us to expand that.
Absolutely. Well, is there anything additional that you want to share with everybody?
I would advocate for the cattle pasture horse combination. I think that's something that is rooted in Arizona in the West, and it's something we should conserve. I believe that we are raising cattle in the most natural way possible here in Arizona, and I think that we need to make it a priority to keep these operations around.
Absolutely. So eat beef and thank a rancher.
Yes, thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Ben, for joining us today. It's been incredibly informational. I hope everybody else got, an education like I did today. Thank you for taking the time.
I appreciate you having me on. This is a great opportunity. I'd like to come on again sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. If you guys have additional questions for Ben, be sure to send them our way and we'll get them relayed, and maybe we could do another live answer session if we've got some time and some questions that we need to get answered. But again, thank you, Ben, for joining us, and everybody can catch us next week on another AgriPort edition of Arizona Agriculture Connection.
Thank you for tuning in today, and remember, Farm Bureau has a place for you. Be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with your friends on socials. You can also visit our website, MaricopaCountyFB.org, for more information and to submit a topic you want to learn about. Remember to tune in every Wednesday wherever you listen to podcasts. A huge thank you to Paloma Ready Mix and Materials for supporting our agriculture producers and this podcast. Maricopa County Farm Bureau, bringing you the stories of real families, real farms, and real food. I'm Nicole Clements, signing off. Catch you next week.